And we're back. What's up, everybody? It's another episode of Wildlife Cake and Cocktails coming at you. It's episode 42. Sticking with the theme from our last show, we're also talking wildlife rehab today. We're talking with Corey Young from the Tasmanian Wildlife Rehabilitation Council. The main subject of our show today is the Rakali, also known as the water rat. But I think the Rakali is a much, much nicer name for such a fantastic animal. And our guest today, as mentioned, is Mr. Corey Young. He started with an interest in canaries and finches and parrot breeding down in Tasmania. But for the last 15 years, he's been involved in wildlife rehabilitation with everything from pygmy possums to wrens and devils, quolls, platypuses, and pelagic seabirds. These days, he specializes in echidna puggles, which are super cute baby echidnas without their spikes a lot of the time, or some of their spikes still developing. Kind of like a hairless, spikeless echidna baby. He also does a lot of work with bettongs, platypuses, some of the larger penguins, and of course with the Rakali. He's the vice president of the Tasmanian Wildlife Rehabilitation Council at taswildlife.org. You can also check them out on Facebook at taswildlife. You can check out Corey on Instagram at cyoung102. And you can check out the Rakali Awareness Day on Facebook. And that is every February 18th, celebrating the wonderful Rakali and awareness for it around Australia. But let's get to our guest. Corey, how are you doing today?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you.
Excellent, mate. Thank you so much for joining us. I hear we just missed you at the office. I believe we called the office first. They said you'd already gone home for the day. You'd had a bit of a busy quota taking care of animals.
Yeah, no, it's been a busy day with animals.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you guys get
do you guys get
swamped in summer as well?
Yeah, we do get swamped over summer, more so towards the end of, I guess, September. Even early August, end of August, probably more so. That's when a lot of our smaller, I guess, pink, non-developed joeys come through, particularly in the Bennett's wallabies and paddy melons. But yeah, our awesome season doesn't really stop down here at the moment. We've still got possums breeding and producing pink young at this time of the year, so yeah, it's constant.
Right. So after summer, you kind of after all the summer breeding activity, you kind of have to deal with some of the fallout of offspring and young. Is that kind of where you guys are at?
Yeah, pretty much. It's also, you know, just started devil breeding season now too, and the quolls are starting to breed, so it doesn't really stop down here.
Yeah. Right. Well, look, it's there's always something taking advantage of a bit of a reproductive niche, isn't there?
Yeah. Exactly.
No worries. So, look, I guess before we get into the Rakali, I just want to, I guess, have a bit of a chat about how you got into wildlife rehab. It's always interesting to find out how people got on these various journeys with animals or their path into it. I understand you started pretty young at around 16 with an orphan paddy melon joey?
Yeah, that's correct. So I was learning to drive on my L's or my learner's license and basically came across a paddy joey. It was quite well developed, so around 330 grams from memory. So well furred, well not full fur, what we call velvet furred, I guess. And then, yeah, I thought I'd be handing that animal over and contacted a friend of mine who did wildlife caring, and she put me onto the wildlife management branch down here in Tasmania, which deal with all the injured northern wildlife. And from there, I was mentored by the head of the branch, you know, raising this little paddy joey, and then a couple of weeks later, once she was settled, I took on a little buddy for her, so we had the two until they were released.
Wow, straight into double paddy melon care. That's like a pretty steep learning curve for somebody getting straight into wildlife rehab like that.
Yeah, so it was good. I was encouraged, I guess, that, you know, it's better to raise them in a buddy system rather than solo, so was certainly keen to do that, and it worked quite well. The paddy was on fire feeds a day, and I managed to do that around school, which was difficult.
Yeah, fit it in around your school schedule. Well done.
Yeah, so it probably wasn't the most ideal situation of raising wildlife, and looking back on it, a lot of things were done wrong, but the animal was still released and successfully bred. So the release site saw a couple of times, so I know she did well, and I know he did well as well. So that's, I guess, what it's all about.
No, that's very good. Well, it's always a good, you know, outcome when we get to see them released into the wild. Obviously, as you mentioned as well, you had a fair bit of assistance there. Were the people around you pretty much providing constant assistance, or is it something that you gotta, I guess, troubleshoot a lot of the time yourself? Or I mean, a lot of the time there is somebody there, from my experience, to kind of hold your hand. But I mean, some of the time you're kind of groping in the dark a little bit.
Yeah, no, the Kappa network's pretty good down here. We have a really supportive network, and yeah, it's pretty much, yeah, you put your hand up and someone's happy to help you. Or we have our local Tasmanian Indian Orphan Facebook page, so a lot of wildlife carers obviously contact for advice on there, or get onto a mentor, which is always happy to help as well. So it is pretty easy to obviously get advice and branch out into different species. So yeah, I was lucky to be able to raise a fair few paddy melons before I moved on to other species.
Very cool, very cool. And we actually spoke about this on our last show as well. That's kind of one of the real positives of, I guess, getting into wildlife rehab. And even if you are working with, I guess, more common species like possums, I'm not sure how common paddy melons are down in your area, but you know, we really only get them kind of up in the Diagula Ranges kind of area up here, and then some of the more rainforesty areas down south. But it does give you that opportunity to upskill, and you get involved in welfare, in the wildlife conservation community, in the wildlife welfare community, and you can, particularly once you kind of cut your teeth a little bit, gain some skills, it's a little bit easier from there to kind of move onto some of those, more sensitive wildlife and really start having a bit more of a conservation impact. Is that what you found as well?
Yeah, it is exactly like that down here. So down here in Tasmania, paddy melons, bennets, wallabies and brush-tailed possums are classed as partially protected wildlife. So we don't require a permit to rehabilitate them. So I guess they fit the more common species category. But they're certainly not, what we call an easy species. Each species has its own challenges, and some are easier than others. And I guess because these guys are more common, they are sort of put down as being a starting species for people to start with. So we always encourage our new carers to, rehabilitate a substantial number of either of those three species before they branch out into a different species, which is quite good. I did 43 paddy melons, 9 brush-tailed possums and 12 bennets wallabies, I think, before I moved on to protected wildlife. So certainly you don't need to do that volume, but yeah, it's a good number to sort of work with before you get, something that I don't like saying there's any species more important than others, but, as far as threatened and endangered goes, we don't want, people who aren't quite confident with what they're doing, raising a Tasmanian devil. We want them, to be very confident with what they're doing before they move on to a species like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as you mentioned, particularly those threatened and sensitive species, or I guess with some of the more dangerous ones. I mean, I really rehabilitated a large number of blue-tongued lizards and carpet pythons and things like that before I started getting my hands on eastern browns and things of that nature.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right too. So yeah, different species pose different challenges. So you need to build your skill level, but also your facilities as well. So, you can raise a paddy melon in a substantial size enclosure, but then you're taking on something like maybe a eastern grey kangaroo or even a wombat. Those animals require huge facilities. So it does come at a cost, and I always think it's great for, carers to start with a more common, less demanding species like a paddy or a brush-tailed possum before they move on to something that is quite expensive. To build a wombat enclosure, you're looking at, $6,000 or $7,000, really, really digging it down deep enough and strong enough to keep one of those in, rather than, you can really cheat with a paddy melon and get a bit of shea cloth and some star pickets and build a decent pen in your backyard if you wanted to. But
yeah, it's not going to keep those little digging machine wombats contained, that's for sure.
You've got to keep those wombats in nicely.
Yeah, yeah. I guess before we move on, how can people in Tasmania get involved? You're obviously VP of the Tasmanian Wildlife Rehab Council. You can find you at taswildlife.org or on Facebook at taswildlife. Do you guys have a lot of events and, I guess, other groups? And is there any other organisations down there that you recommend as well?
So obviously Bunurong Wildlife Sanctuary down here in Tasmania runs Tasmania's only 24-hour rescue service. They're a really great facility, and they certainly cover the whole state as far as rescues go. And they provide free training around the state every couple of months. So that's a really good way to get involved if you don't think you're able to do the full wildlife caring. And a lot of people join their rescue service and then really discover how passionate they are about, you know, any new animal they see or an orphan they find, and want to get involved further. And that's when they go on to do further training to actually become a registered wildlife carer with DPPWI, so, or Department of Prime Ministry's Watering, Parks and Environment, I think it is. So you can certainly contact the Wildlife Management Branch here in Tasmania to become registered as a carer. And they're currently working to get a standardised training out across the whole state, which will be run through TASTAFE, which will obviously be a bit more recognised and be formalised training rather than just the mentor training that's been offered at the moment. And through the TAS Wildlife Rehabilitation Council, we organise various training courses for registered carers already. So recently we just had Peggy Rismiller down from Kangaroo Island doing a kidney course. And we had Rachel Lyons down from upstate Noosa area to do a microbat course recently as well. So,
oh, very cool.
Yeah, we try and provide various training courses for people to upskill a couple of times a year.
Sounds fantastic. And yeah, look, obviously one of the other things is once you get involved and you get involved with an organization, you're going to meet other individuals, and the networking that you're going to have is with those people is not only a lot of fun, but really valuable. And you'll get into some social media groups involved with wildlife care a lot of the time. I find that's also a great way to network around.
Oh, definitely. I think the best thing about training courses, whether you're interested in the species or not, you know, to go and attend them and actually network with other carers, I think is great. And even in Rachel Lyons' course recently, well, actually only last weekend and the weekend before, I attended. I'm vaccinated for microbats and certainly do them from time to time, but I don't do them often. But she was talking about something that I found would apply to my platypus care, so I found that quite beneficial. Complete your separate species and learn about something at a different course. So
yeah, wonderful.
And it certainly is beneficial to attend any training.
Yeah, absolutely. That cross-application can never be kind of discounted. And, hey, upskilling is always good. And you're probably going to meet somebody who can, provide some kind of advice, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, no worries. Well, look, we should move on to our main topic for the day, in honor of which I've got some slightly caramelly cake because of their lovely kind of orangey tufty fur on the underside and on the face there. I couldn't find a Ricali Ricali themed drink, so it's hot, so I'm just having a gin and tonic. But I hear our guest today has himself a lovely Ricali shaped cake, some leftovers from one of their events. So we should get to it. The Ricali, Hydromys chrysogaster. The Hydromys are a genus of semi-aquatic rodents from the subfamily Murinae of the old world rats and mice. They are pretty much the only placentals native to Australia, other than if you're going to consider the dingo. So there's basically three species. They're largely from the New Guinea and nearby islands, but the Ricali is also found on Australia, Papua New Guinea, West Papua, and pretty much from East Australia across the top end to the northwest part of the WA. I think there's an isolated population in southern Western Australia. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah. And they're also found on Barrow Island, Berners Island, and I think it's Dorres Island on the West Australian coast in between that range.
Yeah, okay. Well, unsurprising, because they are an aquatic, very, very aquatically adept small mammal. They basically have this lovely black to brown soft waterproof fur and a dark tail with a white tip and a orangey white underbelly, which I think is just absolutely gorgeous. Now, they're pretty large for a rodent, about, over a kilo, 1.275, around there. About 40 centimeters long. So, they're a fantastic animal. Hind feet are partly webbed with a very streamlined skull and body, are very flattened along the top of the head, kind of to decrease drag, with a long, blunt nose and a lot of whiskers, lot of very long whiskers, and they actually makes them look very otter-like. which is unsurprising. There's a bit of a, I guess, a ecological convergence there and a little bit of morphological and adaptive convergence going on as well. Very cool animals. How did you get involved with the Rekali?
So basically I had a bit of a passion for Rekali. We had, when I used to work at Bonnerong Wildlife Sanctuary, we did have one come into care that came via the Hobart waterfront. It was actually found in the reception of a hotel down there. Not sure what its story was. It was found looking quite lethargic, thought to have maybe eaten something inappropriate.
Right.
We got it into care. It was only in care for a short time. I think we had it for 24, 48 hours. It was pretty much unable to be handled. It was very aggressive. Pretty much lunged at you when you opened the crate that it was in. But yeah, so that was an indication that we thought he was quite ready to go. We gave him some subcutaneous fluids, and he certainly was very aggressive, ate like a champion, and was ready to go. So he was released, yeah, pretty much the next night. After that, I didn't come across one for a number of years, and started speaking to the lady who originally mentored me in my original paddy mill, and she had raised two orphan water rats, or Rekali, that were flushed out of a drain near my primary school I went to, actually. And just thoroughly loved raising them. She said they stink a fair bit. I found they do smell a little bit, but not much compared to some species we rehabilitate. But yeah, so I started talking to her, and then one came into care 4 years ago. It would have been on the 18th of February, which is the one that is what inspired me to start Rekali Awareness Day. So she was found at the Save the Tasmanian Devil breeding program facility in Cressy, in, I guess, the northern Midlands of Tasmania. And yeah, we thought she had a head injury. She was thought to be a juvenile from the few vet appointments we had and the weight range that we had for her. It was only when she improved and she was going really, really well, and I thought we'd better try and work out where we're going to release her and what we're going to do there, that she actually started to go back downhill again. And that was when I took her to a vet, and he had a look at her teeth and aged her, and she was pretty much a senior citizen water rat. So she got dubbed Granny Ratty. And yeah, she was in care. I had her on a permanent permit from the government until she passed away. So she passed away from what we would assume was a stroke-like event. I was in there cleaning her one day, and she climbed into her pool for a swim, and then yeah, pretty much had a seizure and didn't get back out of the water. So that was the end of her. But we had her for 4.5 months. I think she died in July 28th, I think it was. So yeah, she was a special little lady, and yeah, she was very, very spoilt. I think she cost me about $6,500 in 4 months. So.
Wow. Well, look, despite the rough end, we all got to go at some point. It sounds like she had a long, full life for a Rekali.
Yeah, she had a very long life. Yeah, she was thought to be around 3.5, if not 4, which is pretty good for a rodent. Normally, so around 2 or 3 in the wild. So I think she was pretty much on her last legs when we got her, and we obviously provided her with some antibiotics and some pain relief and made her feel a bit better, and she kicked on for a couple of months longer.
So was that a large part of the cost, was all of the medicine? Because their diet is not exactly the easiest thing to take care of either.
No, so the diet was mainly what we spent money on. There was a few bits on antibiotics and pain relief. Obviously, we wanted to keep her comfortable and minimise her issues she had. But, yeah, for the most part, it was food. I was very lucky to be looked after by a lot of the fish suppliers around Hobart, which did cost price for me, or venue price, I guess, rather than the full customer price they'd normally charge. But yeah, I was feeding her a pretty special diet. She did get some abalone and some Moreton Bay bugs, and ooh, she got lots of crabs and scallops and prawns. And
wow,
she just tried to give her a varied diet as much as possible.
Well, yeah, they do have quite a varied sort of aquatic diet, from like insects and fish and crustacean and mollusks, even things like frogs and I've heard water birds, and their eggs as well sometimes end up on the menu.
Yeah, so she got lots of eggs, and I did give her water birds as well. So she was given a non-native duck that came into care. She did get the ducklings from there that had to be euthanized, so she certainly had it easy. She also got some day-old chooks, which were donated from the local poultry farm. So she had lots of different things in her diet.
And I understand that she ended up becoming a bit of a mascot for you guys. But I think we're going to talk a little bit about Rekali Awareness Day in a minute. I think just for now, I want to bring it back to, I guess, some of the old conservation threats and some of the new ones that are around as well. I guess the name, first of all, doesn't exactly inspire a lot of conservation, you know, emotion with the water rat. So I think, was that a large part of the push for the change back to Rekali?
I think that was a big push for the name change to Rekali. Yes.
It's much easier to hunt something called the water rat, I think.
Yeah, so a lot of people aren't so passionate about it. I think the biggest thing for me was when people picture a water rat, for me the first thing I always thought of was that movie of Indiana Jones where they're in the sewer and all the rats are around them, you think of something dirty and not attractive. So I was trying to change the public perception of these guys a little bit and make them realise that, one, they actually are a quite nice-looking animal. They're not ugly by any means.
Absolutely.
But also, too, the fact that they are so specialised to the environment but also have quite great environmental impacts as far as assisting both our farming community and eradicating a lot of non-native species, of course, like the non-native rodents like black rats and brown rats.
Yeah.
They evolved to eat cane toads, which is pretty amazing.
That's
pretty cool, yeah. And down here in Tasmania, we haven't introduced starfish, or sea star, which is causing a lot of issues for our endangered spotted handfish in the Derwent Estuary. So they are eating the Northern Pacific sea star as well. So a big bonus.
Wow. So, well, look, I guess as far as speaking for their looks and bringing it back to conservation, they were hunted for their fur and for their pelt.
Yes, so they were hunted for their fur up until the 1940s, from memory, off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And then basically that was, sort of stopped. And they did try and reignite it again a couple of years after it was stopped. But, they're a highly protected species Australia-wide now. So.
And it's not like there's people out there, trying to catch your average black sewer rat and, strip that for its pelt. So this is clearly a very, very different animal and with a much denser and much more, I guess, aquatic adapted fur. And it seriously is much more otter-like.
Well, that's it. And that was my big push was, getting people to think of them as Australia's otter. And something the Platypus Conservancy told me when I was talking to them, they basically, are Australia's otter. They exploit the exact same niche as what an otter does in parts of Asia and the US and certainly live on a similar diet.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well that they were, first of all, hunted for their pets, and then there was destruction permits, I believe, as late as at some point in the 60s for the idea that they burrowed into dams and ruined irrigation walls and damaged fishing nets, whereas I think the understanding now is that they actually minimize some of the burrowing by crayfish that leads to some of those irrigation issues and leakage issues with dams. So it's kind of the other way around. Is that correct?
That is correct. So, they actually assist a lot of irrigation issues. I haven't read a huge amount up on that, but, it's certainly something that they do assist farmers with. And it's, they're just perfectly evolved for their environment. And they, if people can actually step back and realize that, these guys do things that actually help a lot of the general public and assist with, things like that in the farming community, then people might actually get a bit more appreciation for them.
Yeah, absolutely. What are their current population numbers? And I guess what are some of the more recent threats that they're facing? I guess with the hunting and that kind of stuff being no longer permitted. One thing that I heard of was the Opera House freshwater crayfish and yabby traps can be a bit problematic, which now obviously banned in Victoria to protect platypuses and things like that. Do they suffer a bit of a mortality as well, I guess, as bycatch?
Yeah, so they suffered hugely from bycatch from the Opera House traps. So obviously that was a big bonus. Obviously it was great that platypus were the spokesperson animal for that cause, because I think if it was just the water rats and the freshwater turtles getting caught in these yabby traps, we wouldn't have had such a quick banning of those traps, which is awesome. So that's sort of they exploited the opportunity of the poor platypus. But yeah, both those species and, of course, freshwater turtles suffered dramatically in those upper house traps. But loss of habitats obviously played a big part in these guys as well. So these guys live in freshwater and saltwater. But as obviously people move closer to waterfronts and habitat degradation around the waterfront, certainly changes the ecosystem there and affects these guys' population. And obviously pollution and all that in the fresh waterways, as we see around farms and particularly around the Melbourne area. They live in the Yarra River quite well, but obviously that's not the ideal habitat for them anymore with food dropping. So with pollution and with pollution and habitat degradation, therefore there goes their food sources. So you watch the small crustaceans and yabbies and stuff move out of these rivers and waterways, and then these guys certainly disappear as well.
Yeah, right. So water quality, habitat loss, obviously very important for a lot of species, a lot of other species as well. But I understand that the isolated Southwest WA population in and around Perth it appears to be experiencing some recent declines and even some potential local population extinctions just through a couple of things. First of all, that habitat degradation, even salinization as well occurring in some of those habitats.
Yeah, so that's a big issue. I think it's a big issue Australia-wide with these guys obviously being quite a territorial species. In Tasmania, for example, these guys can occupy a territory of 4 kilometres long of shorefront. So, you know, if a dominant male dies out in that area, particularly in isolated bays, then there's no breeding in that bay for several years, and then population becomes locally extinct. And that's pretty much what we're seeing in a lot of populations around Australia, but particularly down in southwest Western Australia, where that's happened a huge part, where parklands and stuff have been opened up, and lakes have, and rivers and stuff have been basically blocked off or dammed, and then we're seeing areas where these guys aren't actually populating anymore. So damming obviously plays a big part in these guys' population dropping.
Yeah, something definitely to be, monitored and kept an eye on. And obviously, with being so adapted to freshwater environments, climate change in the future, I imagine, is going to be playing a rather large role.
Well, that's it. Both platypus and water rats, or Vicali, are disappearing due to, drought and habitat loss due to climate change. And we're looking at a lot of our lakes and rivers drying up or becoming a lot less bigger than what they were. So then, obviously, territories reduce and then populations decline, and we get, populations that are potentially inbred or, not the most ideal breeding gene due to restricted populations.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess all things to be monitored in the future. And, I guess one way to, improve that is Vicali Awareness Day,
Well, that's it. Yeah, just trying to get a bit of better name out there for them and promote the species as something of ecological importance is huge.
Yeah, which I understand was largely, had a large bit of promotion by Granny Ratty back in the day when she was in her education role for you guys.
Yeah, so she did provide a lot of education. Obviously, with the permit I had her on, she wasn't able to be displayed. And she wasn't an animal that was able to be moved around for school talks or anything like that. She is now taxidermied, so I can take her around for school talks, But, yes.
So she lives on somewhat?
She's lived on, yeah. and at home we've set up Granny's bar, so she's mounted above my bar at home, and she's got the little neon sign with Granny's bar above it. So anyone who comes down home certainly gets the big publicity spill of Vicali. So.
Well, I understand that a lot of the footage that you guys have of her swimming around and doing her otter-like tricks in the little kiddie pool is still floating around.
Yeah, no, the videos certainly float around. I feel like every single time I do any post as far as water rats go or Vicali, she comes back up in one of the videos. There's not huge amounts of videos of Vicali swimming. For the most part, you might see him on the surface swimming around, but not actually doing the underwater antics, which is what really shows off their otter-like behaviour. There was an amazing video a couple of years ago where someone actually was diving and Vicali swam past them, but I can't seem to find that anymore. I had shared it on the original Vicali Awareness Day Facebook page, but it's been deleted off the internet now, so I don't know where that's gone.
I'll have to track it down again. My favorite memory of the Ricalis was out the back near up here behind Brisbane, near Lake Sanford, Lake Wivenhoe. There's a bit of a rocky culvert and a bridge that kind of goes over part of it at one point, and just down at the bottom there, right along the rock wall, there was three or four of them, and they literally seemed to be playing tag, jumping in and out of the water and just trying to get a little bit of a grab on and a little bit of nibble of one of their partners, like lower flank. And then, you know, the game would turn around and the pack would start, you know, chasing each other the other way, hopping in and out of the water. They were like super playful.
Yeah.
Which for a rodent, you don't initially think about. And they really did look like, just a little pack of buddies having a good time.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think they're actually a lot more social on the mainland than what they are in Tasmania. Down here, they're really quite aggressive towards one another. And when you do see them together, it's certainly more aggression than actual play. But there's some great videos that people have got from the mainland of similar things that you've seen, as of them actually looking like they're playing and seem to be getting along and tolerating one another quite closely. But they're horrible to one another down here.
Well, I guess when it gets all cold and miserable, you go down south, it's you got to defend for yourself a little bit harder when the winters are so harsh.
That's it.
Well, look, tell us a little bit about Ricali Awareness Day. How did it start? And February 18th. So what's the plans for the next Ricali Awareness Day?
I really, really want to get soft toys organized for next year's Awareness Day. That's, you know, a matter of financial funding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I approached a lot of the teddy bear companies that, you know, I worked with when I was at Bonnerong and that we work with now at the shop that I work in now. And a lot of them are prepared to make the actual Ricali, but they require a minimum purchase of $500. Mm. So by the time you look at it, I think it's $500 at $10 or $11 each, it kind of comes up to around $5,500. So, I think we maybe need to get a bit more publicity before we invest that much. obviously, there is wildlife parks and zoos that do have them in care, like Healesville, Perth Zoo, etc. But it's a matter of getting them on board to actually sell them in their shop. And the biggest thing with Ricali is they vary a lot in colour over the over their range. So in WA, they're range of colours, yeah. So in WA, they've pretty much got almost a pale creamy white belly rather than the bright orange belly we get here in Tasmania. So that's obviously a bit hard to try and get them to sell something with this beautiful ginger belly to when the people are seeing this white one in captivity there. I do have a friend who makes some wonderful toys at Puddles & Co. down here. So she makes a lot of wombats and kangaroos and platypus. And I'm working with her, and I think she's keen to try and make a couple of Ricali prototypes that we can maybe look at selling, just to promote them a little bit more. So it wouldn't be, you know, your high-profile teddy bear company, but Linda at Puddles & Co. does an amazing job there.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, looking forward to seeing them. How did Ricali Awareness Day get started initially?
So initially, it was a bit of a we'll see how this goes sort of thing. Me and my partner were sitting on the couch, and it was coming up to a year since Granny came into care. So she came into care on the 18th of February. And I had been seeing I get really involved with Penguin Awareness Day, just because obviously I do a lot of seabirds as well. And Wombat Awareness Day, Giraffe Awareness Day. I see all these posts all the time for different awareness days. And I just thought, well, you know, the species that, you know, have these awareness days often are quite well-known species. Like wombats are usually well-known. And as are penguins. A lot of people don't, you know, think about the different penguin species. But for the most part, everyone knows what a penguin is when they see them. I sort of was sitting there and we thought, well, maybe we should try and do an awareness day and see how it goes. And, yeah, I thought we might get maybe 100 shares on Facebook. And we got over 10,000, which was amazing. And we had comments from all around the world. So we had people commenting from France and the UK, people from South America and South Africa, all of which were commenting about similarities to species they had in their areas. So it was really cool to talk with some people from the UK and Europe who obviously were talking about the water vole over there, which is often called the water rat, and that was the inspiration for Ratty from The Wind in the Willows. So it was really cool to sort of think about those sort of aspects of it, that, you know, there's so many other species that exploit the same niche as what a water rat does or what an otter does. So it was really cool from that way. But yeah, I was amazed at how much attention it got that first year. We did go purely with Water Rat Awareness Day that first year. We didn't actually mention Ricali except for in the other name section. And then, yeah, with a bit of feedback from other people, we sort of went with Ricali Awareness Day the following year. And I'm still a bit, we should probably go with both of them, but just because I know it as the Australian Water Rat. So we had a lot of people this year comment, are they different to the Australian Water Rat? And I was like, no, they're the exact same species. It's just the fact that it's a more well-known, not well-known name, but a more prettier name for them rather than the Water Rat. And it's a real touchy subject because I obviously deal with a lot of people who work with non-native rats, because that's how I got my training in raising non-native rodents. So I raised a lot of black rats and brown rats that came into care as orphans, and just for pure learning experience. And then obviously I gave them to friends for pet rats because they're these cool hand-raised rats, or they were euthanized, some of them. But yeah, it was just, so yeah, obviously I deal with a lot of non-native rodent raisers, and they were, got a bit narky when you sort of try and change the name and distance itself from a rat, because they're like, oh, you know, rats are beautiful. And they are.
Yeah, right. I do agree. Look, I mean, they're not everybody's favorite animal, but they are phenomenal, and they do have their place. And I can see the I guess rat fans being a bit miffed that you're trying to move away from the term rat rather than trying to elevate the term rat or rodent. You know, in the end, I do think it is the Ricali, that's a traditional indigenous name for the water rat, isn't it?
It is correct. So I've got a huge list on the most recent Ricali Awareness Day post of all the different indigenous names that I could find for the species. But the Ricali is based on the Murray River tribe in Victoria, or close to South Australian border, actually, more up that end. And that's how that name came about. But yeah, so in the early 1990s, the Australian federal government basically proposed a change from the common name of Australian water rat to Ricali, which basically gained some public acceptance as the common name. But yeah, they're still pretty much widely known as the water rat. So,
well, look, I would argue that prior to the colonial and scientific classification of Hydromys chrysogaster, or the Australian water rat, there were some people around calling it the Ricali. So I think we're pretty good to stick with that.
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so Ricali Awareness Day, everybody, you can get involved on that on February 18th. So a little while away, but mark it down in your calendars. Corey, I think we're pretty much going to have to wrap it up about there. Thank you so much for joining us. Is there any more water rat things that you want to chat about before we wrap up today?
No, that's pretty much, you've covered everything that I would have wanted to cover, so that's all good.
Wonderful. Well, guys, I think that is going to be the end of our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Corey. It was excellent chatting with you. Love seeing all your photos, and can't wait to see some more videos of some of the other Ricalis that people have posted up online. Yeah, very, very cool stuff. Guys, you can follow the Tasmanian Wildlife Rehabilitation Council on Facebook at Taz Wildlife or at tazwildlife.org. You can also check out Corey on Instagram at cyoung102 and Ricali Awareness Day on Facebook at Ricali Awareness Day. That's February 18th. Get involved. And look, it really doesn't take a whole lot to go out and see them in the wild. If there's some, freshwater rivery areas. Corey, any tips for going Ricali spotting?
I am very interested in people's Ricali spotting. So, yeah, I'd love people to get involved. And the whole point of setting up the Ricali Awareness Day and Sightings Facebook page was purely for people to be able to share their stories and their sightings of Rakali. So it'll be really awesome to have everyone post their photos to the page. I'll be stoked to see everyone's post there.
Wonderful, wonderful. That's at Rakali Awareness Day on Facebook, guys. And that is us for the day. Thanks again for joining us. This has been another episode of Wildlife Cake and Cocktails. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, SoundCloud. You can follow us and download all of our episodes on all the platforms. And we will be back with plenty more Wildlife Cake and Cocktails action very soon. Cheers, guys.